This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending Friday, 3rd of November, 2017. Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Hampshire Chronicle from the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper. Liz and Gordon Legg have edited the extracts this week. And we'll begin with the usual regular notice, and the first is to say that if you know someone who's sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording you've received from us, please telephone Irene Dowding on 01962 870370. That's 01962 870370. And as you listen to the recording, remember that you can use the buttons on your box to move on from an item before it finishes, or back to any of the tracks if you want to listen again. Just one more reminder. This is for those of you with computers or tablets. As well as using your memory stick in the box, you can also access the weekly recording of the Chronicle through our website, www.winchestertalkingnews.com. That's all lowercase, no spaces, www.winchestertalkingnews.com. Just go to the website, click on News on the header bar, locate the recording you want to hear, and click Download. The recordings are listed in date order, and the most recent is first on the list. And so, let's look at this week's edition of the Chronicle. Our readers today are Barbara Kearns.
Hello.
Thank you for standing in for Claire. Richard Martin.
Hello.
And Jerry Taff.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, Ros Lydiard. So on to the news. The leading headlines this week are Failings Admitted, Emergency Calls Ignored, Alan Titchmarsh Plants New Rose at Jane Austen's House. And the first headline story from Jerry, please.
Which is Failings Admitted. Social care bosses have admitted failings following the death of a man who fell at a care home near Winchester. An inquest heard how 84-year-old Gordon Peniston died following a fall at the Otterbourne Grange residential home in Otterbourne in May. Mr. Peniston, who'd only been admitted to the Otterbourne Grange on the day of his fall, was taken to the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, where a scan revealed he had suffered head trauma, which he died from a short time later. Now, social care bosses at Hampshire County Council have admitted shortcomings in the way Mr. Peniston's case was handled. Winchester Coroner's Court heard how Mr. Peniston had previously been a resident at the White House care home in Sutton Scotney, and that his social care was being funded by his family. But due to financial issues, it was arranged with the County Council that Mr. Peniston would move. However, Jacqueline Mallee, a safeguarding quality and governance consultant at the Council, told the inquest that Mr. Peniston, who suffered from dementia as well as a condition which affected his vision, making him more sensitive to changes in his environment, should have had a best interests meeting before a decision was made. On the day of Mr. Peniston's arrival, he'd become agitated due to the move, and during a short period that he was left alone, workmen carrying out refurbishments at the care home began drilling, which appeared to agitate Mr. Peniston further. He got up and headed in the direction of the workmen, but suffered a fall. Senior Coroner Graham Short recorded a conclusion of accidental death. Mr. Short said, Hampshire County Council have acknowledged that there was no best interests meeting. I know that changes have been put in place and some are still underway by Hampshire County Council. Hopefully they will prevent others from having the same experience. A Hampshire County Council spokesperson said, We would again like to send our sincere condolences to Mr. Peniston's family. In addition to our own review, we will ensure the coroner's findings and recommendations are fully implemented and all necessary actions taken.
Emergency calls ignored. Police control rooms are under so much pressure, it's forcing crime chiefs to ditch their current system of answering calls. Hampshire Constabulary is paying £27 million in partnership with the Thames Valley Force to revamp a system used by call handlers after new data revealed that thousands of calls to 101 and 999 were left unanswered. Figures from a Freedom of Information request to Hampshire Constabulary showed that 1.1% of 999 calls, that's 3,641 out of 33,000, excuse me, I'll read that again, out of 339,000, it numbers, I don't do numbers, and 13% of 101 calls, over 135,000 out of nearly a million, were unanswered between January 2016 and June 2017. They also showed that 2,696 calls to 999 were abandoned between the same period, while 94,101 calls were unanswered in the same period. Among the worst months was June of this year, when 2% of 999 and 27% of 101 calls went unanswered. The figures have been slammed as excessive and unacceptable by politicians. Royston Smith, Tory MP for Southampton Itchen, said, It's shocking to discover how many emergency calls are abandoned. Currently, too many calls are not emergencies. Too many are hoaxes or pranks, and far too many are going unanswered. But the public must do their bit too. Councillor Sean Woodward, leader of Fareham Borough Council, added, I'm very concerned to see that nearly 10% of calls are being abandoned. We need to know why, and measures need to be put in place to ensure this does not happen. Nobody dials 999 lightly, and all of those calls, not just some of them, need to be promptly answered and prioritised. Police say the new move will allow them to flag repeated callers as useful or vexatious and allow them to see if they're taking advantage. Out of the plans, both forces will install a new command and control platform, which will be used to record all contact from the public, including crime reported online, by telephone or in person. The platform will also be used within the police control room to manage crime and incidents and help deploy officers in emergency and non-emergency situations. In a statement released to the Hampshire Chronicle, Chief Superintendent Christian Bunt said, Police forces across the country are currently facing high levels of demand into their control rooms and contact centres, and Hampshire Constabulary is no different. As a result, we've been working jointly with Thames Valley Police and Microsoft as a technology partner on a programme to deliver a new command and control platform, which is due to be in place in the first half of 2018. It will enable us to provide a more victim-focused response and provide more information to the call handler to enable us to table our response to the needs of the caller. This is particularly important when dealing with people who are vulnerable. The platform will also provide us with all the information we need in one place to improve our efficiency in identifying the appropriate response and provide control room operators with better visibility of available resources and understanding of local crime issues. Michael Lane, Hampshire's Police and Crime Commissioner, added, The 999 and 101 service has been and continues to be under pressure, but I'd like to reassure the public that we monitor performance very closely and that the Constabulary's response to 999 emergency calls and serious threats continues to be professional, impactful and timely. Over the summer, there was an increase of calls that in part resulted from an increase in demand, but also reflected the public need for reassurance following on from the terrible events of this year. The short-term action taken has been to recruit extra staff into our control room. For the longer term, a project is nearing completion and it will improve the public's experience of 999 and 101, and indeed all engagement and communication with the constabulary. Hampshire Police and Thames Valley expect the new system to launch in the first half of 2018.
Alan Titchmarsh plants new rose at Jane Austen's house. A new rose celebrating Jane Austen's 200th birthday was given pride of place at the garden of Jane Austen's house museum by Alan Titchmarsh. The TV presenter planted the rose in the garden of her home in Chawton. The rose was specially developed by Harkness Roses for the museum and was launched by Alan at the RHS Chelsea Flower Show this year. A bright and vibrant orange bush rose with a light sweet scent and deep and great depth of colour was created to reflect the vibrancy of Austen's characters. Whilst planting the rose, Alan talked about the frequency in which gardens were mentioned in Austen's letters and described the museum as a very special place. He also highlighted the museum's recent Bring Jane Home campaign and urged the public to donate their new £10 notes to the museum. Mary Guyot, museum curator, said everyone was really happy to see Alan planting the Jane Austen rose in the author's very own garden.
Thank you, everyone. We'll have the death notices for you now, and that will be followed by Jerry reading Christian comment. The death notices: Arnold, Peter Richard Arnold, Pete, at Southampton General Hospital on the 25th of October 2017, after a long illness bravely borne.
Balding, William Bill Balding, passed away on the 23rd of October 2017.
Barnes, Veronica Barnes of Chandler's Ford, passed away peacefully at Countess Mountbatten House on the 25th of October, aged 73 years.
Bicknell, Michael John Bicknell, 5th of April 1932 to the 21st of October 2017, passed peacefully in Winchester Hospital after a brief illness.
Blake, Audrey Margaret Blake, passed away peacefully on the 21st of October 2017, aged 94 years.
Cheney, Joanna, née Gray, Cheney, peacefully at home on 27th of October 2017, aged 53 years.
Dennis, Patricia Edna Dennis, passed very peacefully at Sutton Manor, Sutton Scotney, on Saturday the 21st of October, aged 93 years.
Hickman, Ted Albert Edward Hickman, previously of Winchester, peacefully at home on the 20th of October 2017, aged 80.
Major, Roy Jeffrey Major, passed away on the 27th of September 2017, aged 91 years.
Plews, Louisa Joan Plews, on 24th of October 2017, in Ashbourne Court Care Home, aged 92 years.
Skinner, Sybil née Watson Skinner, died on the 16th of October 2017, aged 101 years.
Now we have Christian comment, and it's contributed by Mary Gray this week, and it's from Jerry, please.
And it's headed A Richness of Feasts. Forget the tradition of dreary November. There's a richness of feasts to be discovered. At first sight, Halloween is not very Christian, dating from the Celtic farming festival Samhain. This marked the end of harvest and the beginning of winter. Farmers believed there was a day when spirits could rise from their graves. During Samhain, Celtic people dressed in disguise to ward off the spirits, hoping to protect their land through the winter. However, in the 8th century, Christians sought to transform this. Pope Gregory III declared November the 1st to be the Feast of All Saints. The night before became known as All Hallows' Eve, Halloween. During the medieval period, children and poor people would practice souling when they went door to door asking for donations or food in exchange for prayers honouring the person who answered the door. One tradition dates back to Abbot Odilo of Cluny, 962 to 1049. A pilgrim was thrown on an island during a storm. There he had a vision of the souls in purgatory enduring the pain of flames as punishment for their sins. Back at home, he went to Father Odilo of Cluny to ask for one day in the year when prayer could be for the souls of the deceased. So Odilo instituted the annual commemoration of all the faithful departed to be observed by a community with alms, prayers and sacrifices. In fact, soul cakes were the original Halloween treat, and if homeowners did not give out cakes, it was believed their home would be cursed. "A soul, a soul, a soul cake," went the song. "Please, good missus, a soul cake, an apple, a pear, a plum or a cherry, any good thing to make us all merry." The practice of carving and decorating jack-o'-lanterns is an Irish custom that honoured souls in purgatory. Legend has it that Stingy Jack roamed the earth, unable to enter heaven or hell, with only a piece of burning coal in a carved-out turnip to light his way. Since pumpkins are easier to carve than turnips, this ritual adapted into jack-o'-lanterns as All Hallows' Eve celebrations took shape in America. Halloween is now internationally recognised. In my childhood, we simply called it Bonfire Night. For Christians, Halloween announces November, a month of remembering. It evokes the belief that evil forces of darkness were active because the Feast of All Saints would follow the next day. Instead of dismissing this as mere superstition, Christians believe that Christ, the light of the world, will always be victorious over darkness. Both All Saints and All Souls Days are wonderful times for remembering not only local and national saints, but also more recent prophetic figures who inspire us now, like Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Patriarch Bartholomew, the Green Patriarch in Istanbul. I think of my friend, a religious sister in Gaza, running 10 medical clinics. But also let's remember the unnamed, unsung people of courage the world over, struggling for justice today. They need remembering and solidarity, together with our own loved ones. Mary Gray.
Thank you, Jerry. What an interesting article. Right, well, we're going to move on to letters to the editor now, another mixed bag for you. And we've got 12 letters. And Richard, will you start us off with the first, please?
Yes, this is from E. Wright, who says, it'll be fine, apparently. Sir, Michael Woodhall's letter, Chronicle October 26, uses statistics selectively. 10 of the 13 electoral districts in Hampshire voted to leave with an overall majority of 55%. To 45%. He trots out the well-worn arguments of project fear while conveniently forgetting rising employment, falling unemployment, expanding exports and increased tourism. At today's rates, the pound has fallen 13% against the euro and 10% against the dollar. A welcome and much-needed correction. Not 20% as Mr. Woodhall claims. The EU doesn't want us to leave because they're terrified of their budget shortfall. We've contributed $484 billion net at today's prices to the European project since 1973 and continue to pour in millions every day. They have said they will not move a millimetre, or is it a half inch, in negotiations. But Mr. Woodhall can reassure our farmers that when we finish paying these extortionate sums, we will look after them as we choose. It's French farmers who should be feeling windy. I lived through the Second World War, and to imply that the EU has maintained peace in Europe since is not only ludicrous, but fails to recognise the mighty cost to Britain of that peace. It's also deeply disrespectful. We lost much of the flower of our youth, and the £120 billion it cost us to fight a German dictator was finally repaid in 2006. It's NATO that has kept the peace, and Britain has contributed about £5 trillion to it since 1949. We're one of the oldest working democracies in the world, and we have the fifth largest economy. It is sophisticated and highly developed, with a population of 65 million, larger than the total of the EU's 15 smallest countries. We have nothing to fear. We will leave the EU. We will control our borders. We will regulate our spending. We will enact our own laws. E. Wright, Alexandra Road, Chandler's Ford, Eastleigh.
Disaster awaits. Sir, how right Michael Woodhall, a former long-serving Hampshire County Councillor and one-time chairman, is. Brexit Chaos Letters, October 26. Additional to his list of disasters that await us, I can vouch from personal experience that the London property market is dead and that locally does not appear any better. This is causing my family and many others to make difficult decisions. It is all due to the folly of the current and former Prime Minister and those MPs who, like lemmings and sycophants, have followed the party line. When will those who are pulling the strings see sense? My parents were paid-up working-class members of the Conservative Party for all their working lives. We lived in a tied cottage, and both parents worked extremely hard to give me and my sister a reasonable standard of living and good education. My father was a gardener, and my mother a daily help, as were my grandparents on both sides of our family. I also had the honour of being praised in a newspaper article by Sir Harold and Lady Dorothy Macmillan, who was probably the last of our great prime ministers, and was myself, when an idealistic student, a member of the Anti-Common Market League. I too have voted Conservative for over 50 years, believing the party to be a safe pair of hands. But no more. Since the ill-judged and severely flawed referendum. Hopefully, the Conservative Party will at long last recognise that its future depends on completely changing its stance towards Europe, and it will bring an end to the inordinate amount of time and money that has been wasted since June 2016 in trying to convince the electorate to the contrary. If nothing else, the uncertainty and argument is affecting both their physical and mental well-being. We deserve better from our politicians. We need another John Hampden or William Cobbett to stand up for the common man. Ian Stenning, Legion Lane, Kingsworthy.
This is a third letter on Brexit, so I hope you're ready for it. It comes from Roger Stevens. M. Darmanim bemoan in the Chronicle Letters, October the 26th, bemoans the fact that the Brexit negotiations are proving more difficult than Brexit leaders led us to expect. Did they really think that the EU negotiators would be a pushover and let us cherry-pick all the things we wanted with none of the obligations? If that is the case, it indicates a disturbing lack of judgment and calls into question all the other benefits they predicted. The Brexit leaders who promised us £350 million per week are now saying no deal is an acceptable outcome. Do they believe that our goods and services will be welcomed by the people of the EU if, in their view, we have left all the difficult issues up in the air and failed to pay our bills? Having behaved like this and thrown away any prospect of amicable relations with the EU, our closest neighbour and major trading partner, can we expect great trade deals from the other nations of the world? If 74% of the country believes that no deal is acceptable, then 74% of the country has been misled. The media resonates with Brexiteers blaming others for the lack of progress in the negotiations. But the fact is that the Brexit leaders have full control of the government, with a parliament that voted overwhelmingly for Brexit. Yet they are incapable of moving forward and negotiating a deal that parliament would accept. In desperation, they espouse a British bulldog, no deal scenario, and intensify the witch hunt for Ramonas under the beds, as if the people who point out the difficulties that lie ahead have somehow created them. I appeal to all those who have fallen under the Brexit spell to ask themselves whether media outlets that brand law lords traitors and enemies of the people for upholding the law, and which attempt to silence any voices of dissent, are really acting in their interest. Roger Stevens, Cliffway, Compton.
And moving to a slightly different area, under the heading Closet Socialism, James Anderson writes, last August, Oxford professor Dieter Helm was commissioned by the government to assess our electricity supply chain. His Cost of Energy Review is now published. It's on the government.uk/publications site. I commend it to anyone with an interest in politics. The national press and TV have generally painted his report as a listing of policy mistakes, resulting in our electricity being overpriced by some 20%. In fact, Professor Helm's report is far more fundamental and is a worked example of the consequences of a command-and-control political mentality. One can easily envisage that a similar report on the NHS might reach similar conclusions, perhaps of interest to our MP, Steve Bryan. Unfortunately, the governmental command and control mentality on electricity extends from Labour's Ed Miliband through Lib Dems' Ed Davey and on to the Conservatives' Amber Rudd. From the electorate's perspective, the current political choices might appear to be between proclaimed socialism and closet socialism. When Peter Rees and Karen Barrett run their MOPE, Most Oppressed People Ever, thesis, they do no more than demand multiple repeats of the failings listed by Professor Helm. The joys of democracy. James Anderson writes close South Wanston.
Welcome delay. Sir, Highways England's delaying of capacity increases on the M3 and the A31 is one of the few causes for celebrations I have heard in recent months. I am not in the least surprised, however, that Councillor Humby and our MP are disappointed by this delay. Both central government and the county council have always shown a consistently wrong-headed sense of priorities on transport matters. Road capacity increases have been known to be self-defeating for decades. Congestion relief leads to traffic growth, which leads to congestion growth, all of which brings carbon emission, air pollution, lifestyle health costs, landscape, habitat and heritage destruction, as well as demonstrating no overall economic benefit to the nation. The sooner we kick this ridiculous and clearly unsustainable habit, the better. How does a government obsessed with austerity, that has starved the public realm, has made rail travel prohibitively expensive for many, and which has brought the NHS and social services to the brink of collapse, manage to find the huge sums of money for road schemes around the country that serve no conceivable sustainable purpose? How does a county council, which has recently been making decisions to cut back on so many public services, including the virtual demolition of rural bus services, find the millions to subsidise the Stubbington bypass? If the ruling party political reaction was predictable, it was disappointing to find that your editorial supported this misdirection of transport funding with almost petrol-head enthusiasm. Why do you consider that in these times of growing difficulty for so many, besides motorists, that money should be spent in this way rather than on encouraging sustainable and healthy alternatives, on public transport, on making space for cycling and walking, on tackling pollution and carbon emission, and even, dare I say it, on mending potholes. Chris Gillam, Upper High Street, Winchester.
This one from Una Stevens is headed Cut, Cut, Cut. I understand concerns such as those raised by Mrs. Spears and Dr. Phyllis Lander in the Chronicle letters October the 26th relating to Hampshire County Council's proposals to axe community transport funding. Notwithstanding, I remain appalled by other cuts which have already been backed by the Council, aimed at the most vulnerable, including £56 million to social care and £30 million to children's services. It is disturbing that the Council has plucked a number out of the air, namely 410 children, whom it has dispassionately decided will be deprived of the opportunity to be taken into care by 2021, as reported in an article in the Hampshire Chronicle, October the 19th. How can the Council possibly predict the exact number of children whose plight should prompt them being removed from their current home? What if the number exceeds 410? Will all additional children just be left in extremely difficult circumstances? In a callous attempt to save millions of pounds by slashing vital services, it will be defenceless children who suffer. Yet Councillor Perry has the gall to state that the saved money will be spent on developing a new social care IT system. What is wrong with the current one? Is it currently failing some of our most vulnerable children? Is it impossible for it to be tweaked at a lower cost? Janet Kierkia raises pertinent points, including the need to balance the books. I dare to make a few suggestions. 1. The Council's budget has shrunk, resulting in contracted services. As councillors will have less to manage, it's high time that their salaries should reflect a reduction in their responsibilities. 2. It's time that Hampshire County Council challenges our local Conservative MP, demanding an explanation of the austerity cuts imposed on local authorities from central government. 3. If the answer is cut, 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 it is high time that the reprehensible response of the County Council to such cuts should be signalled. Where is the integrity of a council which claims boldly on its website to represent all its residents, which persists in targeting so many of its highly vulnerable members? Una Stevens, Cliffway, Compton Down.
Chris House complains of a misunderstanding. What a shame the Chronicle wasted 7 and a bit inches of column space printing Peter Hargreaves's letter in reply to my letter last week, whinging October 26th. Clearly Peter Hargreaves did not understand my letter, so I will clarify and make it easier for Peter Hargreaves to understand. I was not complaining about what Winchester City Council has done or not done to improve the living conditions for the residents of Hyde Lodge. It's done an excellent job to greatly improve both the inside the common room and outside the garden areas. I've always said that. What my letter was simply doing was questioning what the health and safety rules difference was between one heavy picnic table and chairs, which the City Council took away because it might injure one of its workers when lifting to cut the grass, and replacing it with another heavy all-in-one table with seating. The new table may be even heavier. That's all I was doing. The actual heading on my letter said just that. What's the difference? Finally, I should like to point out that it's got nothing to do with Peter Hargreaves, whether or not I take part in the lodge's activities or I get taxis into town. Peter Hargreaves should stop nosing out of his window and at the same time commenting publicly on what I do with my life. P.S. Should any resident of Hyde Lodge happen to be going into town at the same time as I am, going by taxi, you are more than welcome to a lift. Chris House, Hyde Lodge, Worthy Lane, Winchester.
Ben O'Regan from the University of Winchester is disgusted. Sir, I'm a second-year journalism student studying at Winchester and have found that this city is full of greatness from its scenery to its people. However, I find myself confused. How do you feel morally about condemning a very small and vibrant student population for adding a small amount of diversity to this ageing city? Chronicle, October 19. Frankly, I'm disgusted. Your paper is scattered with misprints and errors, so I assumed that this story followed your track record in being complete garbage. I was correct. You have cemented the notion of failing regional newspapers stooping to the lows of tabloid journalism for attention, and as an aspiring journalist, am using you as a model for what I don't want to be. In short, I wish for an apology to be made to the University of Winchester and all its students for what is an unjustified and hurtful attack on people who are paying large amounts of money to achieve great and amazing lives. Failing this, I will launch a counter-article and protest outside your branch in Winchester. In future, please think. Ben O'Regan, University of Winchester, Sparkford Road, Winchester. Letter editor's note. A classic case of shooting the messenger.
This letter from Adam Nicholas is entitled Answers, Please. Ground investigation starts on a new £37 million leisure centre, as reported in the Chronicle, October the 26th. Councillor Gottlieb stated on these pages that the case for a new leisure centre is unarguable. I doubt it. What is not in dispute, however, is that he's failed to respond, despite repeated requests, as to how the £13 million pumped into River Park Leisure Centre by the City Council over the last decade was spent. Winchester taxpayers deserve answers, as well as future projections as to the funding of Bar End. Is £37 million enough? Really? Adam Nicholas, Paintersfield, St Cross, Winchester.
And Avril Burt makes a plea not to divert Andover Road. Sir, how sad that the only reply to my letter, Chronicle October the 19th, was for Mr Keane to criticise me rather than our elected Hampshire councillors, who will mostly be unaffected by the traffic problems caused by closure and rerouting of traffic on Andover Road through Barton Farm. If more land is needed for the Henry Beaufort School, perhaps the army could oblige, or a new school built on the soon-to-be-vacated site in Andover Road. Winchester City Council are busy redesigning a city without concern for access. Access from the south is already limited by traffic from Winchester Village and further developments in that area. The closure of the Andover Road could be the last straw in deterring visitors to our city. Avril Burt, Downs Road, South Wanston.
And Mrs. Louise Musselwhite would like to vote for Kevin. Sir, aww, after reading the Hampshire Chronicle, I would like to point my vote for the friendly big issue seller, Kevin Colick, to turn on the Christmas lights in Winchester. I wrote to you a few months ago suggesting this along with many others, and I think it will be such a refreshing change to have somebody actually connected to Winchester, and that most he know and recognise, to do this year's honours. Mrs. Louise Musselwhite, Cranberry, Otterbourne.
Hear, hear. And thank you very much for all of those. We're going to move on to your say now, and this is in the light of Sadiq Khan's statement that London needs to build 66,000 new homes. And the Chronicle's roving reporter questioned to the public asked whether Winchester needs more homes, and Barbara has their answers.
Well, David Simmons, 75, a retired taxi driver of Imber Road, Winnall, said, "The students have taken over all the provided houses. There must be 15 houses with students in. Now they've moved them all from Stanmore, they've got rid of the problems there." Janet Peacock, 58, a librarian from North Baddersley, said, "The problem is they don't build the infrastructure. They put these new developments in the middle of nowhere, but as soon as we reach our late 50s, we need to be near a bank, surgery, a pharmacy." Paul Cusworth, 70, a retired sales engineer from South Wanston, said, "They should also make more use of brownfield sites. They could be converted at less cost. Brownfield is the way to go." And David Rees, who's a surveyor in his 60s of Old Rectory Lane, Twyford, said, "Make more of the city centre. All the space over the shops is empty. You go to France and Italy and it's all apartments. We need to use the space more effectively."
Thank you, Barbara. Now, if you have an opinion or a subject that you'd like to air in the Hampshire Chronicle, you can contact them on 01962 860 836. That's 01962 860 836. Or you can email news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk. All lowercase, no spaces. news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk. Or you could also write to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. You could even drop in when you're in Winchester. We come to Chronicle comment now, and the editor's topic this week is on that business of the ignored 999 calls. It's headed up Answers Needed on ignored 999 calls. Most people will be shocked that thousands of 999 calls made by members of the public to the police in Hampshire have gone unanswered in the 18 months between January 2016 and July 2017. More than 100,000 calls to the 101 likewise never get through. We report today that police control rooms are under pressure and it's forcing an overhaul of the way the police respond to the public, whether on 999 or 101. Hampshire Constabulary is paying £27 million, along with the Thames Valley Force, to revamp a system used by call handlers after the new data revealed that thousands of calls to 101 and 999 have been going unanswered. Some 3,641 out of the 339 and 68,000 emergency calls, that's 1.1%, and 13% of 101 calls, 135,345, out of 985,816,000 were abandoned. We welcome news of the £27 million investment to make the service more efficient. The figures are surprisingly high, and we echo calls from politicians for the police to explain what has been going wrong. The public will demand that the police are as open as possible as to what has been happening, but politicians must be prepared if the honest answer is that financial cutbacks have simply gone too far. And we have some items now for you from Balgarum, that alternative Chronicles report of the news. Jerry's got the first, please.
Which is headed Public's Favourite Artwork. A painting of Colebrook Street has taken first prize at this year's Winchester Art Club annual exhibition. Painted by club member Jack Harding, the winner was chosen by members of the public who visited the exhibition held at the Winchester Discovery Centre. Jack was unable to collect his prize as he's currently in South Sudan flying humanitarian aid helicopter missions. So his mother, Jane, collected the prize on his behalf. She said, "Jack only joined the club in July and was delighted when three of his pictures were accepted for display. He'll be thrilled when I tell him one was chosen by the public as the best." Despite having had no art education since taking his O-levels at Westgate School, Jack began painting helicopters during off-duty periods. Discovering he had a talent, he now creates colourful compositions of many subjects. More than 2,000 people visited the Art Club's annual art exhibition, where more than 25 exhibits were sold. A further exhibition is in the main corridor of the Royal Hampshire County Hospital until January the 8th next year. All of the pictures will be up for sale, with a proportion of the proceeds going to the hospital's children's charity. And if the name Harding, coupled with Jane, sounds familiar, that will be probably because Jane is a valued member of the Talking Newspaper team.
Griffin's Pilgrimage. A Winchester family have returned from a humbling visit to the British Great War cemeteries on the Western Front. The Griffins visited to honour the memory of William Knight, who was killed at Passchendaele on October the 26th, 1917. Trevor Griffin, retired firefighter, told Belgarum that they had learnt a lot about what their ancestor had gone through. There were several other families there commemorating the death of relatives 100 years ago. A service was held, attended by around 50 people at Varley Farm, where William's regiment saw action. Trevor emailed, "Many unknown Marines were buried at Pulcapella Cemetery close by. Whilst not certain, it is very possible that our relative lies in one of the graves marked, known only unto God. I shall return for Armistice Day 2018 without doubt." William, aged 10 and named after his ancestor, said, "I found the trip really interesting. I learnt William was shot by a German sniper. He was only 18. I wore my great-great-uncle's medals and I was really proud."
Shaking the hands of 2,500 graduands. TB Gardner and Chancellor of the University of Winchester, Alan Titchmarsh, reckons he shook hands with about 2,500 students in the last couple of weeks. Alan, who left school at 15 with just one O-level, before carving out a highly successful career as a gardener, broadcaster and writer, presided over four graduation ceremonies at Winchester Cathedral between October the 17th and 20th. The Hampshire Chronicle printed a supplement with all the graduands' names last week. But he's not complaining about any risk of arthritis in his right hand. "It's an honour and a delight. The university has a tremendous ethos. It's very inclusive and really does try to do its best for students, pastorally as well as academically."
Thank you. And this next item for all of us is the historical round of news from 200 to 25 years. But I thought you might be interested first in this item, which is written about the Queen Mary. It's headed up "When the Big Stars Landed in Hampshire." And Ian Crump looks back on the days when the Queen Mary carried celebrities to Hampshire. She saw royalties, Hollywood stars, world leaders, millionaires, sports stars, politicians and television personalities. The list of those who travelled on the Queen Mary was like a comprehensive guide to the celebrities of her age. Many famous faces who opted for the glamorous life viewed her as the only way to travel across the Atlantic. And that meant that Southampton was the focus for the arrivals and departures of the biggest names in show business. There are so many that the most national newspapers had at least one journalist based full-time in the city through the 1950s and 60s. Comedy duo Abbott and Costello, who starred in 36 films, two television series and numerous radio shows, were passengers on the Queen Mary when they changed their baseball jokes into football gags for the British audiences. Debonair actor David Niven was a firm favourite on the QM, where he would regale other passengers with stories of his life in Hollywood. "Cunard looked after its celebrities impeccably," says Elspeth Wills in the book Stars Aboard, which chronicles the many well-known names who were passengers during the golden age of the Atlantic travel. Cary Grant proposed to one of his five wives in Queen Mary, while film producer Samuel Goldwyn, stalked the liner's decks with his camera at the ready in case he spotted a photogenic new face. Marlena Dietrich followed her friend Noel Coward's advice, always be seen, dear, always be seen, by timing her entrance to the dining room for maximum effect. She was never seen at breakfast and only rarely at lunch. Notoriously publicity-shy Greta Garbo travelled incognito and disembarked disguised as a stewardess, while Bing Crosby sought refuge in the darkroom where he chatted to the photographers as they developed that day's film. In the 1950s, the Shah of Iran was synonymous with wealth and luxurious living and caused a stir among the passengers. When he travelled on Queen Mary with his second wife, the Empress Soraya, the extent and exquisite quality of her wardrobe caused a sensation. Changing her clothes several times a day, she never wore the same outfit twice, and her entry to the room was the event of the day, says the book. Among the actors who sailed on board were Audrey Hepburn, Buster Keaton, Elizabeth Taylor, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., Judy Garland, David Farrar, Gracie Fields and Mickey Rooney. Comedians who walked the boards of Queen Mary included Bob Hope, Sid Field and Laurel and Hardy. Movers and shakers, Fred Astaire and the three Ross sisters were among those who ventured into Queen Mary, as were politicians John F. Kennedy, Winston Churchill and General Dwight Eisenhower. Queen Mary also saw her share of royalty, including George VI, the Queen Mother, and Queen Elizabeth II. This week, in 1967, the Queen Mary left Southampton for the last time, sailing to the west coast of the United States. And so we're going to move on to the news now, and I'll have the first, which is 200 years ago. 1817, Monday, November the 3rd. Drowned on his passage to Ireland, Lieutenant Snow of the 2nd Battalion of the 66th Regiment, now in this garrison, son of John Snow, Esquire, of the County of Kilkenny, a promising young officer whose loss is generally deplored by all who knew him. He was one of the fortunate passengers on board the William and Mary packet, which was lost in the Bristol Channel. Our second page is a melancholy detail of the distressing catastrophe, which is attributed by the survivors to the mate who, instead of attending his duty, was imprudently romping and playing with a girl, leaving the helm to a man who appeared a stranger to that perilous coast. Oh dear. The second item, Monday, November the 3rd, 1817, we are happy to learn that a society about to be formed in this town for the purpose of superseding the necessity of climbing boys in the dangerous occupation of sweeping chimneys, its object will be to promote the use of machinery in cleansing them. But as the attendance of a man and boy will be necessary to superintend the apparatus, the objection usually started on this subject, that it is completely destroying a trade, will be quite groundless. A subscription is now raising here to carry into effect the philanthropic scheme, and we beg earnestly to recommend it to the public attention, in the confident hope that this appeal to their benevolence will not be made in vain, and that all will lend their aid in rescuing the friendless orphan from an occupation as degrading, as disgusting as it is to humanity.
100 years ago, Saturday, November the 3rd, 1917. Henry White, Esquire, City Coroner, and a jury, of whom Mr. A. Hinton was foreman, held an inquest at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital on Monday afternoon, touching the death of Iva Sharp, aged 10, daughter of Mrs. Mary Sharp, widow of Colgan Common. Henry George Clark of Maugham Cottage, Twyford, said he was manager for Mrs. Sharp, who carried on an oil and general store at Colgan Common. About 10:30 on Saturday morning, he was in charge of a trade motor lorry containing oil, etc., and was calling on customers at Hill Rise, Colgan Common. The deceased was accompanying him, and they were serving some 7 or 8 houses each stop, the deceased going to some and he to others. She'd just come from 3 cottages, and he was moving on with the motor lorry to the next stop, 10 or 12 yards ahead. He'd started the car some 50 yards back and was about to stop again. He saw the deceased coming towards him, and as he passed, she stood by the side of the road, as he thought to allow him to pass. After the front of the car had passed her, she made a move to get onto the footboard. The coroner asked, "She suddenly jumped onto the car?" The witness replied, "She made a step to get in onto it, but missed her footing and fell." The near side of the back wheel passed over her shoulder. And the second item. Henry Webb of Lower Wolvesey Terrace was summoned for, and pleaded not guilty to, assaulting and ill-treating his son, Calais William, aged 12 years, on October the 23rd. Mr. R.J. Harris appeared for the NSPCC to prosecute and stated that 2 children, a boy and a girl, lived with the defendant, and this was not the first occasion he had assaulted his son. What happened was that on fair day, the boy played truant from school, and having caught him at the fairground, the father, taking a thick stick, thrashed him out of all proportion to the offence he had committed, also taking him by the head and banging it against the buffer of a railway truck.
50 years ago, Saturday, November the 4th, 1967. In a highly charged atmosphere of party politics, Winchester City Council wrangled on the issue of council housing for 3.5 hours on Wednesday night. Before the council was an amendment calling for the acceptance of a revised plan of terraced houses on part of the land owned by the council at Abbots Barton. But what caused a major quarrel was an amendment supported by Conservative councillors saying that before the council is committed to any future building programme, there should be reports on the needs of the city's waiting list, nearly 100 people, the desirability of restricting further building, and the possibility of selling parts of the Abbots Barton Lane to private enterprise. When it came to a vote, the council was evenly divided, 10 votes to 10, and the mayor, Alderman DJ Smith, cast his deciding vote in favour of the amendment. After the vote, Councillor S.G. Spicer, Labour, declared, "I consider this the most spurious load of humbug Canton hypocrisy that I've ever heard in the 4.5 years I've been on the council." And a second item, the Lands Committee are to consider further the offer from Winchester Rural District Council to help pay for the loss liable to be incurred by the city's indoor swimming pool and indoor sports centre. The RDC have agreed to pay the sum equal to 1/6 of the annual financial loss of the pool, provided it does not exceed the product of a half rate, estimated at £8,000.
And there are 2 items from 25 years ago. Friday, October the 30th, 1992. Proposals to build 90,000 new homes in Hampshire would put an intolerable strain on the county's countryside and infrastructure, County Council Chairman Dudley Keep said. Eagle Star is still promoting its proposed new town at Mitcheldever, strongly opposed by the County Council and local people. I had hoped the company would wait for the Secretary of State for the Environment to make his decision on Hampshire's strategic planning policies for the whole of the county. Our policies, which have attracted massive public support, call for restraint, with business and the environment maintained in harmony. And the second item. Gerald Malone, MP for Winchester and Alton, is to press the government to toughen the law on New Age travellers. Following a visit to a farm in the constituency where 19 sheep had to be destroyed after an attack by a dog belonging to travellers who had set up camp nearby, Mr. Malone said the consultation paper published by the government, which contained proposals for the reform of the Caravan Sites Act 1968, was useful, but could not deal effectively with the problems unless further measures were included.
Well, thank you all very much. Now let's have a look at what's on in the region over the next couple of weeks. And of course, this item's going to get busier the closer to Christmas, so there's some beautiful music to be looking forward to. The first item I've got for you is under the heading of Talks and Meetings in the Hampshire Chronicle. And on Monday, November the 13th, Alan Titchmarsh. Prose, poetry, stories, and a bit of gardening. That's at the John Stripe Theatre, University of Winchester. It's at 7 p.m. It's in aid of SWVG, a charity which supports asylum seekers and refugees locally. I'm sorry, that is locally. The price for the ticket is £13.50, students £10, including a glass of wine and a soft drink from the Cathedral Visitors Centre. If you want those tickets, you can ring 01962 857 275. That's 01962 857 275. And the next item we've got is coming from Barbara, and it's on light infantry.
Hide soldiers.
Ah.
Soldiers killed in the Great War will be remembered in a poignant tribute in Winchester on Wednesday, November the 15th at 6:30 p.m. Army cadets will give a short presentation at St. Bartholomew's Church in Hyde on the local servicemen who were killed in the war between 1914-1918 and whose names are on the memorial at the church. 77 from Hyde were killed. Researching the men who gave their lives has become a part of cadet training locally. Meanwhile, Lightbox 459, the metal art installation with 459 illuminated holes to symbolise the number of men from Winchester killed in the war, is at the church until Sunday, November the 12th.
Well, we can move on now to what's on stage, but first I'll give you news of a concert, Verdi's Requiem. That's on Saturday, the 11th of November. The conductor is Jamie W. Hall, and it's Romsey Choral Society. And they're with the Waverley Singers, Southern Sinfonia, Romsey Abbey. That's the Verdi Requiem at Romsey Abbey. Sounds delightful. And the Visitors' Centre is the place where you get tickets. I'll give you the number now. 01794 512 987. That's 01794 512 987. Or you can get it via the Royal Choral Society's website. The tickets are £20 or they are £14 unreserved. Unfortunately, they don't give us the address of the website of the RCS, so I'm afraid you'll just have to rely on that telephone number. I'm sorry about that. The next thing is on stage in Winchester, White Christmas, Wednesday to Saturday, November the 15th to the 18th at 7:30 and 2:30. That's the Winchester Musicals and Opera Society. And it's Irving Berlin, as you all know. And I thoroughly recommend that you go and have a look at that. They're usually so entertaining. Chesil Theatre Winchester has a production going on until the 25th of November. And they're doing The Hound of the Baskervilles. And that's from Saturday to Saturday, November the 18th to the 25th at 7:45 p.m. And there's a Saturday matinee. That's 2:30 p.m. That's on October the 25th. Thoroughly recommend that one. I've seen some of the rehearsals and it's really good. The next item is at the Plaza Theatre, Romsey. And they are showing Hay Fever. Tuesday to Thursday, November the 14th to the 18th, 7:30, at the Plaza Theatre, Romsey. The box office for that is 01794 512 987. 01794 512987. And I realise I omitted to give you a booking number for the Chesil Theatre. How could I do that? That is a box office number of 0333 666 3366. And I hope you get to see at least one of those. Very entertaining. And that's it as far as what's on this time. And our last item in the regular features this week is first person, of course. And it's from Ron Allison, and he's contributed his thoughts. So Richard will read them for us. Thank you very
much.
And
it's headed 60 Years of Today. The BBC has a tradition of marking anniversaries. Usually this is done for a very good reason, not least that the resulting programme is often a particularly fine piece of broadcasting. The subjects nearly always speak for themselves. The outbreak of war or the first man on the moon are obvious examples, but sometimes the programme reminds us of something significant we might otherwise have forgotten about altogether. Only rarely do I find myself wondering, why on earth are they bothering to remind us about this? It's certainly been appropriate of these past few weeks that on Radio 4 they've been celebrating 60 years of Today, or as most people seem to say, the Today programme. When it first came on air at the end of October 1957, it was scheduled as two 20-minute editions in among the news bulletins and Lift Up Your Hearts, somewhere between 7 and 8.30 from Monday to Friday. It immediately struck a chord with listeners and clearly was an idea that deserved developing, though who then would have forecast it would still be doing so well over half a century later. In the early 1960s, Today became part of the News and Current Affairs Department. The length of the programmes, still two editions, was extended, and they were clearly becoming far more news-centred. Who presented the programme became a matter of national interest. The first to become the regular voice was Jack DiManio, who is for many in listeners' memories as the chap who couldn't tell the time. He left the programme in 1971. I think most people missed him. As one of those BBC reporters who contributed to the programme from time to time, I certainly did. Through the 70s, Today developed steadily into the programme we know now. Two presenters, John Timpson, based in London, and Brian Redhead in Manchester, proved to be a great double act. Both were well-informed, quick-witted, excellent broadcasters and interviewers who helped to set the news agenda for the day. A list of those who followed them would be too much for the space available, but among the distinguished cast were Peter Hobday, and to help balance the agenda and budget, as it were, Libby Purvis, Sue McGregor and Carolyn Quinn. And so that entertaining, informative mix of news, politics, comment, debate, sport, thought for the day and weather is still the start of the day for some 7 million listeners. And it remains lively and provocative enough to infuriate a good few of them. If it was pleasing everyone all the time, then the programme would not be fulfilling its duties. Now it's the presentation hands of John Humphreys, Sarah Montague, Justin Webb and Michelle Hussein, more recently joined by Nick Robinson, who took over from James Naughtie. John, you may have noticed over the years, is Welsh. James is a Scot. Long may they all continue. And while our thought for today seems to be broadcasting, let us throw the switch to television. If Today represents the best of radio, then what about the standards reached on BBC One with the new series of Blue Planet 2? This was television of the highest standards, superbly narrated by Sir David Attenborough and filmed by some of the very best and bravest of cameramen. If what they did was taking a deep breath, what they produced was genuinely breathtaking. An absolute treat.
Right, well, before the general news, we're going to give you the lighting up times. They're starting on Saturday, the 4th of November. The sun will set at 4:30 p.m. And on Wednesday, the 8th of November, the sun will rise at 7:10 a.m. and will set at 4:27 p.m. We really are moving into winter, aren't we? I hope you're all cosy and warm, because we're going on to the general news now. And Jerry, we'd like your first article, please.
Which is, wartime pilot, 99, takes to the air again. A former Second World War pilot has fulfilled his ambition and taken to the skies once again, days before his 100th birthday. Mosquito pilot Tony Farrell was inspired to fly again after being presented with a Bomber Command clasp earlier this summer by the Mayor of Winchester, David McLean, recognising his wartime service during his 50-year flying career. With the support of his sons, alongside Mike Austin, Nick Goff, Colin Wright and Peter Clough, former flying students from the Hamble College of Air Training, Tony was taken for a flight in a Cessna light aircraft from Popham Airfield, and at the grand age of 99, he took the controls unaided for part of the flight. During the flight, Tony revisited some of the familiar landmarks he looked down on daily during his many years as an instructor, including airfields at Worthy Down, Southampton, Hamble, Bewley and Leon the Solent, as well as local landmarks such as Southampton Docks, the Needles and Portsmouth Dockyard. Alongside pilot Peter Clough, Tony was joined by two team members from Sunrise of Winchester for the flight, and other residents from the community had a trip out to the airfield to see him take off and land. When asked how he found the flight, Tony said, "It was great to see so many places from the air, which I'd never expected to see again." Beginning his flying career in 1936, Tony became a highly decorated Mosquito pilot during the war, before becoming a flying instructor at Hamble when he left the RAF. Throughout his time flying, he's exceeded an impressive 16,400 hours in the air. Already holding the Distinguished Flying Cross and Air Force Cross, he was also recently appointed Knight of the Legion of Honour, France's highest award, for his major role in the liberation of France in 1944, and will be presented with this medal on November the 5th, his 100th birthday.
Deputy resigns after 6 weeks. Weeks after accepting a £64,000 a year job as Deputy Police and Crime Commissioner, Flick Drummond has left her post because she couldn't build a professional relationship with her boss. Michael Lane, Police and Crime Commissioner for Hampshire and the Isle of Wight, announced that Miss Drummond would no longer work as his deputy, leaving the role by mutual consent. Miss Drummond, who only took on the position on September the 5th, was tasked with developing and running campaigns to support Mr. Lane's priorities, as well as increase engagement across the region by representing him at events and meetings. In a statement, Miss Drummond, a former Winchester City Councillor, said, "Sometimes it's just not possible to build a professional relationship between two people, though no fault of either party. In such a situation, it's right I leave to avoid any disruption to the work of the PCC and his staff." The former Tory MP for Portsmouth South lost her seat in June's general election, but said she intended to pursue her ambition to be re-elected to Parliament. Mr. Lane said he and Miss Drummond seemed to have the complementary skills to make Hampshire a safer place. However, he said, the relationship between a PCC and his deputy has to be close, and unfortunately, it's become apparent that this could not happen in his case. Following talks, we've both come to the decision that this is the best course of action to take.
Fundraising bid for much-loved therapy horse. A staff member at a Hampshire charity centre has launched a crowdfunding campaign to cover the vet bills of a much-loved horse. Mr. Sin, a 22-year-old black cob, has been working at the Hampshire Riding Therapy Centre, HRTC, in Colden Common near Winchester for the past 15 years. He suffers from COPD, a condition similar to chronic asthma in humans, which means he often has difficulty breathing and requires regular veterinary treatment as well as close monitoring. Following a recent increase in the pollen count, Mr. Sin has developed colic, which needed immediate veterinary attention, resulting in a £700 emergency bill.
The centre, which provides tuition and therapy to adults and children with a variety of special needs and disabilities, was badly flooded in 2013, and extensive repair work has severely restricted the centre's finances, forcing them to turn to crowdfunding in order to raise the necessary money for Mr. Sin's treatment. Staff member Abby Cook, who created the Just Giving page, said, "He is a true gentleman, absolutely adores his cuddles and pampering, and has been a real confidence giver for many of our clients, able and disabled, over the years. This horse has given so many people the confidence to fulfil their dreams and aspirations, and now the tables have turned and he needs our help. Your kind gestures and support will allow the charity to continue forward in getting Sin the care he needs. He is a huge asset to the centre and has given us so much. Any donation, no matter how small, will be hugely appreciated for this one-in-a-million horse." At time of going to press, the appeal had raised £520 of its £700 target. Mary Miller, equine administrator at HRTC, said, £520. Thank you, everyone, for your kind donations. Will really help with medications."
Hobbit Houses Scheme for Valley. They look like something straight out of a J.R.R. Tolkien novel, but these earth-sheltering homes proposed for the Test Valley countryside have been rejected. The planning committee at Crossfield Hall Romsey on Tuesday turned down the application. The plans, designed by Portes and Richardson Architects, propose three single-storey, four-bedroom homes on land to the north of Stockbridge Road, Timsbury. Their unique design uses the earth sheltering building technique, whereby the house is partially or wholly sunk into the site and then covered by soil. This allows the earth to provide insulation for the home, making it fossil fuel free, low carbon, and a greener alternative to standard insulation. Applicants Michael Wigley and John Glasspool are the site owners. Their motivation is that they and their families aspire to remain living in Timsbury with a lifestyle that has a light touch on the planet. However, planners at Test Valley Borough Council marked the application for refusal, despite several local residents supporting it. Richard Bradshaw of Romsey added, "There's a real need in this country for developments that both address the need for more housing and are sympathetic to the environment. This development addresses both issues. I live nearby and I'm a regular visitor to the local area. I can see no reason why this development would negatively impact the area. It is a creative and thoughtful proposal that would help the local council set a fantastic example to many others. But not everyone agrees. Michelmersh and Timsbury Parish Council say it opposes the plans. The site is in the countryside. The development would be contrary to the current borough local plan," its objection letter read. "There is no shortfall in the five-year supply of housing land." And there is an artist's impression of the proposed scheme, which looks really interesting.
Fall at home led to death in hospital. An elderly woman, Hampshire woman, died from complications arising from an unwitnessed fall at her Lyndhurst home, an inquest in Winchester heard. Frances Davy was discovered by her cleaner on the floor of the bathroom in her bungalow in the Meadows on the morning of July the 6th. Hearing Mrs. Davy calling out for help when she arrived, the cleaner quickly let herself in and found the 96-year-old propped up against a wall with a large cut on her head. The retired housewife later told her daughter, Chloe Knight, that she didn't feel ill or faint beforehand, she just found herself on the floor. Emergency services were called and she was swiftly taken by ambulance to the Southampton General. A GP's report revealed that Mrs. Davy had poor mobility, was profoundly deaf, suffered from heart problems, type 2 diabetes and asbestos inhalation. Miss Knight said she had a fall previously and didn't go out after. She was aware she could fall and took everything step by step. Unfortunately, while in hospital, Mrs. Davy's condition deteriorated and she passed away on July the 12th from heart failure. The coroner concluded that Mrs. Davies' death was the result of an accident.
Campaign against ugly waste bins. Council chiefs have launched an initiative to clean up Winchester streets and make the city more tourism friendly following a meeting with business owners. At the meeting, Winchester City Council set its vision for how to ensure unsightly trade waste bins aren't left out on the city's streets. It included targeting businesses which often leave bins out, offering advice about reducing and managing waste, and setting up written agreements to improve the situation within a specific time frame. As previously reported, councillors voted to punish businesses to the full extent of the City Council's powers under the Trade Waste Initiative if they don't cooperate with plans to tidy up Winchester's streets. A report outlining the scheme, which is a three-way partnership between the City Council, Winchester BID and Hampshire County Council, said that the council aims to make Winchester a premier business destination and improve the quality of the district's environment. The report added, "A well-presented city is an attractive one for visitors and encourages them to spend time and money in local shops and eateries." A combination of collaborative approaches and enforcement will be undertaken to encourage behaviour by businesses that will bring about an improved environment in the city centre. Following the meeting with business owners, Councillor Jan Warwick, City Council Portfolio Holder for Environment, said, "By introducing this trade waste initiative, we intend to deliver a cleaner, tidier and safer city centre for all. Working with our partners and the various businesses involved, we hope to find waste management solutions which will prove effective for the whole community." The initiative comes following a rise in the number of food outlets opening in the city in recent years, with Patisserie Valerie, Pret a Manger and Warren's Bakery just some to have opened in 2017 alone. Caribbean restaurant chain Turtle Bay will also be coming to the city, with the restaurant currently under construction. A council spokesman said, "The council is exploring a number of options to encourage businesses to dispose of their waste safely and responsibly."
Charity Christmas shop opens. The Mayor and Mayoress of Winchester officially opened the city's annual charity card shop. Situated in the Tourist Information Centre of Winchester Guildhall, the shop, open till December the 16th, raises cash for more than 50 local and national charities. Last year alone, the venture raised £60,000, with every penny going straight to the worthy causes. On opening the shop, Winchester's Mayor, Councillor David McLean, said, "We really enjoyed opening the charity Christmas card shop. It's great to see the people of Winchester coming together to support charity. It was heartening to see." She said, "It's a team effort and something I believe is beneficial to Winchester. It brings people in." However, despite being a popular attraction for over 30 years, the card shop's future could be under threat, as organisers need to find a new home for the shop's card racks when they are not being used. They're looking for someone in the local area with spare storage to keep them safe during the off season.
New mural. A children's ward has unveiled a new set of murals to celebrate the 10th anniversary of a purpose-built assessment area. Commissioned by Sophie's Appeal, a charity set up to fund the purpose-built Sophie's Place at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, the Under the Sea artwork was revealed during the celebrations in the Northbrook ward. Mike and Lynn Barringer founded the charity in memory of their daughter Sophie, who received treatment on Northbrook Ward before she died in 2004, and said, "Knowing that we're making a difference to other families is really special. We feel incredibly proud of Sophie's legacy and what we've been able to achieve in her name. Sophie was a very sparkly little girl who loved bright colours, so we know this would put a smile on her face." Katie Hulbert, one of the nurses, was there to help celebrate the 10th anniversary. she said, so able, sorry, to effectively observe the children as they play and are engaged with everything in the room. It's really nice for the children and their parents to be able to come into a bright and colourful area, which helps to make sure they're relaxed. The artist behind the murals, Kelly Griffiths, added, we came up with the water underwater theme because we were sure that it would appeal to all the children. We even added some of Sophie's lost treasure, special gold coins with stars on them. The project was hard work, but it was all worth it when you see the children spotting their favourite characters.
Lantern Parade. Residents are being sought to light up the streets of Winchester this Christmas as part of the annual Lantern Parade. The parade, which is one of the highlights of the city's Christmas calendar, will see people strolling through the cathedral's outer close with their own homemade lanterns between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. on November the 30th. There will also be carols led by Churches Together Winchester, and the evening will end with a fireworks display. Winchester Cathedral will also be working with Fair Oak Craft Centre Bella Crafts to run lantern making.
Thank you very much, everyone. And that brings us to the end of our extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle this week. Some of them really interesting. And we are moving closer to that time of year. Before we go, I'd like to give you another reminder that Irene Dowding is the person to call if you have any problems with your recording. Her number again is 01962 870370. 01962 870370. And we'd like to say thank you to all the support teams for the preparation and the dispatch of this edition, and to our editors, Gordon and Liz. And of course, many thanks to our readers. Barbara?
Goodbye.
Thank you for standing in. And Richard?
Goodbye.
And Jerry?
Bye.
Thank you very much for joining us. And from me, Roz, until the next time, goodbye. Would you please put the memory stick in the wallet when you've finished with it and return it to us as soon as possible. And thank you again for joining us. Have a good week.